From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, the Justice Department opened a civil rights investigation into the shooting death early Tuesday morning of a black man, Alton Sterling, by two white police officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The decision came after several protests and today's press conferences, and also after cell phone video surfaced showing officers wrestling Sterling to the ground and then shouting that they see a gun, a warning it is difficult to listen to.
They shot him.
37-year-old Alton Sterling had been selling CDs outside a convenience store. He was shot several times in the chest. This morning, Police Chief Carl Dabadie called it a horrible tragedy.
When officers arrived, Sterling was armed, and the altercation ensued that resulted in the loss of his life. Exactly what happened at this time is the reason we are here today. Like you, there is a lot that we do not understand. And at this point, like you, I am demanding answers.
Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards appealed for calm.
And I will say that based on the information that I have obtained from law enforcement, but certainly the footage that I observed of the video that was made available, I have very serious concerns. The video is disturbing, to say the least.
Sue Lincoln is news director at WRKF in Baton Rouge. And Sue, reportedly someone called 911 and said someone was waving a gun outside a convenience store. But what do we see on the video? Is the man brandishing a gun?
No, he was not. As what we can see from the cell phone video, of course, it did not start until the taser had first been fired.
He was tasered, so,
Yes, he was tasered twice, wrestled to the ground, and pinned to the ground by one of the officers. Actually, it looks like both of them. It's partly obscured because he's at the front end of the car. He doesn't appear to be resisting, but it's hard to know because we don't have the full video.
Right.
All we have is a cell phone shot at the time.
And we should say we don't have the officers' body cameras because the police are saying that they were knocked off.
That is what has been said. Witnesses at the scene also said that the video cameras, the body cameras, were dangling from the officer's vest.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Well, the mother of one of Alton Sterling's children passionately defended Alton Sterling today as his 15-year-old son sobbed nearby. Let's listen.
As some may know, Alton sold CDs and was doing just that, not bothering anyone, and had the consent of the store owners as well. Now, if we could reflect on the measure of a man, it should not be judged on his past.
It was pretty heartbreaking to watch, but talk about that past, Sue Lincoln.
What we do know is that he had multiple arrests, though only about four for a 37-year-old man. One he was convicted for was for having a gun and selling marijuana. He is also known to be a convicted sex offender, and that was for having sex with a minor. We don't have any details on that right now.
And as such, we understand he would not be allowed to have a gun. But again, do we know that was the gun visible? Was it out of his pocket? Because the police at that time presumably did not know they were dealing with someone who'd been convicted and shouldn't have a gun. It could have been somebody who legally had a gun.
Correct, but we don't know. The gun itself does not appear in the video, and all the reports that we have gotten through the newspapers from witnesses at the scene say that the gun was in his pocket at the time.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, the Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation. What's the sense, what's the feeling there in Baton Rouge?
There is a sense of despair from the African-American community. They are concerned that it has come to this. There has been a lot of effort to try and calm tensions by folks in the religious community, by folks involved with police. And we're hoping that the powder keg doesn't go off, but everything is set for that to possibly happen here. because for the second day in a row, we are under a heat advisory with temperatures, feels like temperatures, getting up into the 110s.
Well, and we also heard one of the leaders in town calling for a boycott. And so perhaps that's how opinions will be expressed. Sue Lincoln, news director at WRKF in Baton Rouge, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, a month from now, the Olympics will be underway in Brazil. And Rio's mayor said this week that the city will be ready, but he also cautioned that visitors should moderate their expectations. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And he's with us now. Mike, I want to play you what Saturday Night Live did recently with Rio readiness. They had Colin Jost, the newscaster, and then Maya Rudolph came on as the Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff.
Now, hold on. Are you concerned with everything that's going on in Brazil? Do you think you're prepared for Rio to host the Olympics in just 2 months?
Nah. But we only have one or two things left to do, such as take 1 million poo-poos out of the river and build all the buildings.
Wait, hold on.
Okay, build all the buildings. Now, it's a joke, but how ready are they, Mike?
They don't seem that ready. And that reference to the river, that was probably more about Guanabara Bay, where they'll have the sailing events. And it's heavily polluted. It possibly will be dangerously polluted. The pollution levels change depending on the water currents. And scientists say that there are things in the water that just shouldn't be there. So that's about where the athletes will go. And when you think about the infrastructure, they're still building the subway that should connect the hotels to the venues and the athletes' village. And there's tons of construction still going on. Some of this happens, it seems, with every game. But I do have to say that it seems that Rio right now is much, much further behind and almost dangerously so than any Olympics I've ever seen.
Well, and when you say this happens each time to a certain degree, you know, Sochi, they said they're not going to have any snow. And in Beijing, they said they're not going to be ready. And London, you didn't hear it quite as much. But certainly in Athens back in 2004, there were a lot of questions about whether they would be ready. But they end up being pretty much ready. Do you think that it will actually be different this time, that by the time the Olympics roll around, there are going to be significant things that are not done?
Well, a lot of those reports actually aren't overblown. I mean, the Sochi Olympics, there were huge problems with many hotel rooms in the athletes' village. No one died because of it. And with Rio, especially with the crime situation there, it does seem a little more dangerous. The other thing I would point to is Brazil, the whole country of Brazil, hosted the 2014 Soccer World Cup. And there were deaths there. I mean, we tend to forget it because they were a little bit away from the games, but there was a collapse of an overpass and people died. And this was directly because of rushing to get things ready for the games. So I don't see, given the precedence of other countries, given the precedence of Brazil, how people don't think there are going to be at least some bad things happen. I think the question is how bad and who will they affect?
So are we asking too much of these cities then to prepare for these big Olympic games if it's so difficult for them to get ready?
Well, I think some cities know, like London, but then you have the problem of, do you only give international sporting venues to, you know, what used to be called first world countries, countries that can snap a finger and have the infrastructure ready to go? You know, when Brazil got the games, when Rio got the games, Brazil is a developing country, but it really was developing and was on a good trajectory. The economy shrunk by about 4% last year. It is backsliding in a serious way. They can't pay their police. A policeman was at the airport with a sign saying, "Welcome to hell," greeting reporters who were there for the games. And then you have the question of, so do you only give it to the first world countries? But by giving it to Brazil, are you doing them a favor or are you giving them a curse? These Olympics will cost $20 billion. They'll make about $5 billion. How is that helping a horrible economy? They're saying it puts them on the map. To some extent, I think it's taking them off the map.
So is it better then to just have the Olympics in, you know, London, Los Angeles, Tokyo, cities that have hosted it before that can do it and it's not that big of a deal comparatively for them to put on these games?
I think not. I think that if they are the World Games and the World Olympics, you should spread them throughout the world and have different countries have the opportunity to host. I know South Africa is proud of how it hosted its World Cup. But I do think that the countries that actually bid for it were in this cycle where it's such a white elephant that only a certain kind of country will bid. Sometimes an autocrat who wants to burnish his credentials. Sometimes a country where they don't have to react to the will of the people. So it's really up to the international organizing committees to pick better and to not saddle anyone who raises their hand saying, we'll take the Olympics, to not saddle them with this massive amount of debt.
So best case scenario and worst case scenario for the Rio Games, Mike Pesca.
I mean, best case is there are some mishaps and it's not calamitous. And we remember Phelps winning medals and Simone Biles setting records and sporting events. And we get out of there and the country of Brazil that we leave behind somehow rebounds. And I don't want to think about the worst case scenario. Really bad things could happen.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
We're less than 2 weeks away from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. The Democrats meet in Philadelphia the week after, which means not only will we be able to take off the presumptive title for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, but we'll also know very soon who their running mates will be. To sort through the short list for both parties, let's bring in NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, how are you?
I'm doing well, and we've got some surprise news today in the Veep Stakes, which is that Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, has told the Washington Post, and this is, by the way, less than 24 hours after he was with Donald Trump on the stage in North Carolina, has told them that he is not going to be a candidate for the vice president. He's taking himself out of the running. What do you make of that?
Well, that's probably bad news for Donald Trump because Bob Corker was definitely somebody who gave him some policy heft, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, someone who really made a name for himself on the auto bailout, seen as a very reasonable yet conservative senator. So it's somebody who Donald Trump could have used on his ticket. It's not clear Donald Trump would have picked him anyway. Their rollout kind of didn't go so great, and the image of the two of them going around that everyone saw was kind of superficial, but it was Trump being really tall and Corker being really short didn't appear to really work.
That matters, the height of the candidate?
Yeah, the optics and the imaging, at least. You want balance on a campaign, on a presidential ticket, and we'll talk about that.
All right, well, let's get to some of the people who are still in the running. And starting with one of the people that Trump met with over the weekend, Joni Ernst, the senator from Iowa. Now, she delivered the Republican response to the president's 2015 State of the Union. Here she is.
There's nothing our nation and our people can't accomplish. Just look at my parents and grandparents. They had very little to call their own except the sweat on their brow and the dirt on their hands. But they worked. And because they did, an ordinary Iowan like me has had some truly extraordinary opportunities.
Domenico, tell us a little bit about Joni Ernst.
Well, she's the senator from Iowa. She's a military veteran. She, you know, rose to fame during her ad for her campaign, where she said that she grew up castrating pigs on an Iowa farm, and that she would go to Washington and quote make them squeal. So, you know, the problem, though, I think with her, you know, she brings a lot of energy, but in a way, frankly, she'd be like a do-over of picking someone like Sarah Palin, who she's drawn a lot of comparisons to, and you know, maybe if Trump wants a shot of energy and hopes that she doesn't make a mistake. And again, do no harm is the number one most important thing that a vice presidential candidate can do. If he wanted to pick her, maybe he would do that to boost a little bit of energy and fire up conservatives. But I'd say she has an outside shot at this point.
All right. Over the weekend, Trump also met with Indiana Governor Mike Pence. Here is Pence at this year's National Rifle Association annual meeting.
We're freedom-loving people in the Hoosier State. We cherish all of our rights, our unalienable rights to life, to liberty, the freedoms enshrined in our Bill of Rights, and Hoosiers have supported the Second Amendment every step of the way, and we always will.
Now, Pence has been in office since 2013, but he's been in politics for a lot longer than that as a member of Congress. What would he bring to a Trump ticket?
Well, he's a heartland governor, brings a level of competence, certainly, and would be somebody who would be a governing pick, but also someone who could motivate religious conservatives. He would affirm Trump's conservatism and dedication to conservatism, and would certainly be a base motivator, and maybe in our highly polarized elections, that's what's important.
The other two kind of establishment names that have been put out there are New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who, of course, was one of the first candidates to drop out of the Republican primary race and then throw his support to Trump, and former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Let's listen to Gingrich here telling Bill O'Reilly on Fox News that he thinks President Obama is a socialist.
He has appointed all these extra constitutional czars. I mean, go through step by step all the different interventionist things in this administration, and it is by a big margin the most socialist, the most left-wing, the most big bureaucracy administration in American history.
So he would certainly fulfill the attack dog role of a veep right. candidate, but also somebody with a lot of experience in Washington. What do you think about a Gingrich or a Christie candidacy?
I think they're pretty fascinating wild cards. I mean, Gingrich would certainly be a governing pick. It might be him, but not sure what he brings aside from, like you said, a level of being this attack dog and some policy wonkishness, certainly. But he's been out of office for so long that it's hard to see how he captures the imagination of the current American populace. But then again, Donald Trump wants to, quote, make America great again. And I'm not sure which era he's talking about. Maybe it's the 90s. I don't know. Chris Christie would be a doubling down pick. New Jersey brash, certainly different from someone like Mike Pence, who's much more reserved.
Would be hard to run on a platform of making America go back to the 90s while you're running against the person who was in the White House during the 90s.
This but election's already in the 90s, already, Jeremy.
I guess so. Well, anybody else we should be talking about on the Republican side before we move to the Democrats?
You know, Tom Cotton, who's the senator from Arkansas, Donald Trump seemed to like his appearance on Meet the Press. He might be a little young. He's a freshman senator, but he provides a level of kind of sternness and rigidity that maybe and seriousness that maybe Trump could use.
We're speaking with Domenico Montanaro, who's NPR's lead politics editor, about the candidates, the potential candidates for vice president on either side. And let's move to the Democrats, Domenico. Hillary Clinton has a smaller list of potential options. It seems, but at the top of that list, it's been mentioned over and over again, former Virginia governor and current senator Tim Kaine. I interviewed him last month and asked him about the VP possibility. Here he is.
Jeremy, I'm only playing one role with the Hillary Clinton campaign, and that's doing everything I can to help them win Virginia. Virginia is a state that was pretty irrelevant in presidential politics for a long time and is very relevant now. And so that's the only role I'm playing with the campaign, and I just have this feeling if we can help her win Virginia, she'll be president. So that's my highest and best use, and that's the only role I'm playing.
Okay, that's the only role he's playing right now, but we don't know what's going to happen. What do you think about a Kaine candidacy?
Well, you know, he doesn't bring the kind of diversity that maybe Democrats would be looking for as far as the fact that he's a white man. But that might be the kind of diversity she's looking for. I mean, white men are a vulnerability that she's had. And again, do no harm is a really important thing here. And he is the most risk averse pick because he does stick to the message very well. He's been on a debate stage. He doesn't fire up the base. But again, that might not be the most important thing.
There are three Latinos in the mix. Julian Castro, who is the Housing and Urban Development Secretary and former mayor of San Antonio, Labor Secretary Tom Perez, and also Javier Becerra, longtime congressman from California. Here is Becerra on the East Capitol steps in March.
It's been 273 days since our colleagues in the Senate passed comprehensive immigration reform. 273 days that the Republican leadership here in the House has done nothing.
What do you think of these three?
Well, I think Congressman Becerra probably likes having his name out there and it's attached to this, but I kind of doubt that it'll be him. I mean, of those three, Julian Castro was somebody who early on was seen as potentially being on the ticket. He campaigned with Hillary Clinton a little bit last year. Wasn't the most outstanding performance. It was okay. But I think of them, Perez, who's Obama's labor secretary, is probably the best bet. Fires up labor. He's got Dominican ancestry. The downside is he's never been on a debate stage, which does introduce some risk.
He's never been elected to office, right?
That's correct.
So the other person that's been talked about a lot is Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts. Who
she has.
Some people on the Democratic side think that she would bring that Bernie Sanders enthusiasm from the left wing of the Democratic Party into the general election. Let's listen to her with Clinton in Cincinnati last month campaigning together.
We're all here today because we're with her, and we're going to work our hearts out to make Hillary Clinton the next president of the United States.
So given all the people we've talked about, what are Elizabeth Warren's chances at this point?
I think it's very unlikely. I think that as a vice presidential pick, she introduces the potential for risk. She could overshadow Hillary Clinton, frankly, in certain ways. Plus, it's not necessary for Hillary Clinton to pick her to bring the left on board because Elizabeth Warren's already endorsed Hillary Clinton. They had that great event together that they saw was very good. And she can play the attack dog role without having to be on the ticket and get under Donald Trump's skin, which is what Hillary Clinton would hope, without having to be attached necessarily to Elizabeth Warren.
Do you expect that the VP pick on either side is going to be a game changer, or does it really matter who the VP pick is? Are people still voting for who they want to be president?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that 8.5 minutes into our talk because I don't think it matters very much. I think that people vote for who's at the top of the ticket, not who's on the bottom. The first rule of picking a VP, though, what does matter is if they mess up. You have to pick someone qualified who could step in. Do they not do any harm? And you want some balance. President Obama picked Joe Biden because he had more experience and could help him be a governing pick. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a vice presidential pick who's really move the electorate since JFK picked LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, who was really able to bring the South onto the ticket. That is just kind of a mythology in our modern politics that somebody could be able to even bring a state. The evidence that political scientists have looked at is that it's marginal, if any, improvement that a vice presidential pick can give you in even their home state. But they can, again, introduce some potential problems, and you want to avoid those.
NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro talking with us about the Veep stakes. And we're going to find out in the next week or two, maybe three for the Democrats, who the Veep candidates will be. Domenico, we'll be watching. For doctors, listening to patients is often a key piece of figuring out what's going on. But what if listening to people's voices could tell doctors things that patients themselves don't even know, like whether someone has a brain injury or maybe having a stroke? Rebecca Robbins is a reporter with STAT, the health and medicine publication, and as our weekly partnership continues with STAT, she joins us. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, what do doctors think they may be able to diagnose by listening to how people talk exactly? What conditions?
So on one hand, you have mental conditions like depression, bipolar disorder, concussions. And there's also interest in using this technology to diagnose cardiovascular and respiratory conditions, for instance, heart disease.
And how does the technology work?
The idea is to be able to use deep learning computer algorithms to be able to look at huge amounts of data and from there detect correlations and, in fact, causation between changes in how people talk and their speech patterns, and to be able to link that to certain diseases.
But wouldn't you have to know a lot about the way that someone speaks normally when they're healthy to figure out what they're like when they're not or when they have some problem that needs to be diagnosed?
That's right. That's why huge amounts of data are so key to the ambitions of the scientists and entrepreneurs working in this space. You certainly have to have reams of data to be able to provide meaningful and accurate diagnoses.
And yet it's still worth it for the companies that want to do this to get all of this data to do this diagnosis? Is there not an easier way to figure out if someone is suffering from one of these conditions?
The idea behind the flurry of interest in this field is that these monitoring technologies would conceivably be in the background of everyday life. So you would have your consumer devices monitoring the way you speak every day and could pick up changes over time. So you don't have to go into the doctor's office. In theory, this would be something that's just in the background of your everyday life.
But I imagine there's also a lot of skepticism, especially if what you're basically saying is somebody would be recording you all day long.
That's right. So you certainly alluded there to the privacy concern, and that's certainly something that has raised questions. But a lot of the advocates of this technology make the case that because they're not interested in the words you're saying, rather they're interested in how you talk, whether you're slurring your words, elongating certain sounds, speaking more nasally, even changing your pitch for periods as short as 10 milliseconds, that shields consumers from some of the privacy risks often associated with recording. On the other hand, there are a lot of pragmatic and practical obstacles to getting this to work. For one, accuracy is a real question. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what the source of changes in speech patterns is. It's also really hard to get high enough quality recordings to actually be useful. And as I alluded to earlier, you certainly need a huge amount of data to make sure that what you're seeing is in fact signal rather than sound.
So how close is this to becoming a reality?
I think we're quite a ways away, but there's a growing amount of interest here, and a lot of players are pouring money and resources into development. So I think this is a field to watch as it matures.
That's Rebecca Robbins, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Rebecca, thanks.
Thank you for having me on.
And now that we are fully, officially into summer, bring on the books. Here with some suggestions is Petra Mayer, an editor with NPR Books. Petra, good to speak with you again.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
And, you know, for some people, vacations are sometimes the only time they can read.
Yeah, I know. I have to read for work, which is an odd thing to say.
So you probably take a break.
Yeah, vacation is when I read for myself.
That's right. All right. Well, let's see what you would recommend. The first is a book that people may have heard about. Scott Simon had this author on as a guest. It's Homegoing by Yah Jesse. It's a story of slavery. It encompasses both Ghana and the United States. Tell us more.
Yeah, this is a book that a lot of people are talking about right now. The author was born in Ghana and grew up in Alabama, and book kind of draws on that duality. It starts in the 18th century with two sisters, or half-sisters actually, in Ghana, and one of them marries the local governor and stays there in sort of relative luxury, and the other is imprisoned and taken to America as a slave. And the book sort of follows these parallel branches of the family down through the centuries with, you know, great attention to the terrible impact of slavery. It's not an easy read, but Karen Grigsby Bates, who's a correspondent with Code Switch, called it the epic you've been waiting for. So I think if you want a meaty and immersive summer read, this might be something for you.
Wow. Yeah. And we will link you to Scott Simon's interview at herenow.org so you can get a taste. Okay. I can't believe the whole Manson era, the whole Manson story is back again. There's another book getting a lot of attention, Emma Klein's The Girls. And this is about a young woman who gets caught up in what sounds like a Charles Manson-like cult. Tell us about the book.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the Manson murders are the sort of story that'll never go away. I think it's just going to keep echoing. Actually, I just finished listening to a series. There's a podcast called You Must Remember This, which is about Hollywood history. And they did an in-depth 12-part series on the Manson murders. Mm. So I was super ready for this book to come along, because what's very interesting about it is, you know, when you think about Charles Manson, you think about how magnetic he was. But this sort of flips the dynamic. Emma Klein comes at the story from the perspective of a teenage girl who, like teenage girls generally, just desperately wants to be seen and noticed. And she gets that attention from a group of young women who are clearly part of a Manson-esque cult. So it's very, it takes the part of an outsider in this situation, of a woman in a normally sort of very masculine narrative. And it's part of that genre that I like to call one fateful summer books. You know, my life was changed forever by that one fateful summer. Mm. So it's a pretty good example of that. It's spooky. It's definitely going to send a chill down your spine.
Okay. So not for kids.
No.
Yeah.
No, no, no.
Yeah. Okay. Your next selection, Modern Lovers. This is by Emma Straub. She's the daughter of the horror writer Peter Straub. Mm-hmm. And at first blush, it sounds like, no, two couples and their teenage children living on a block in Brooklyn.
I know, aging hipsters in Ditmas Park. I know, don't turn off the radio just yet. But I think the way that Emma Straub approaches these couples and the various undercurrents in their relationships, the idea is they're sort of sliding toward midlife crisis. Three of them used to be in a band in college. Of course, they all went to Oberlin.
Of course.
And the fourth member of their band is the one who got famous and died young. And as the book opens, they find out there's going to be a movie about her. And it sort of sets off this. They all basically fly into a tizzy.
Okay. But, well, the reviews have been extraordinary.
Yeah. So. It's very thoughtful. It's very sensitive. It's very funny, even though I haven't made it sound funny. And there's also a cat named Iggy Pop, which is a great name for a cat.
There you go. Okay, moving on to science fiction and fantasy, which we know you love. Mm-hmm. Central Station by Lavi Tidhar. NPR reviewer Jason Sheehan says he holds the title for the best opening paragraph in the history of modern science fiction. So we have to hear it. Can you read it?
Sure. I'll read you part of it because some of it's not fit for a family radio station.
Yeah.
But here are the opening two sentences anyways. The smell of rain caught them unprepared. It was spring. There was that smell of jasmine, and it mixed with the hum of electric buses, and there were solar gliders in the sky like flocks of birds. So that really puts you in a place, and the place that it puts you is a far future version of Tel Aviv that's dominated by a giant interplanetary spaceport. And it's sort of a set of interlinked stories all following the same groups of characters. You know, one of the things that I love that attracts me so much about science fiction and fantasy is the world building. And you really do get a sense of the way it smells and tastes and what the air feels like. It's this sort of dusty, bustling spaceport with all kinds of people, with, you know, returning Martian spacemen and data vampires and antique booksellers and cyborg soldiers all mixing together in the streets and probably having a beer together. It's a great world to spend some time in for your summer vacation. Why not?
Okay, why not? If you can't go anywhere, we always say this, if you can't go anywhere, go in a book. Go deep in a book.
Go to the library.
Right, and it'll take you places. Another author who writes science fiction, Ken Liu. He has a collection of short stories, The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories, an author from Stoughton, Massachusetts. And we read he does most of his writing while commuting from his home to Boston to his day job as an intellectual property consultant.
Which is truly amazing because he's written some big doorstopper books. Yeah. The Paper Menagerie, which is a central story in this new collection, won like every single award possible. And I was reading it here in the studio just now, and I was tearing up because it's so, I'm looking at my notes and my notes say, mother, son, paper, animals, Chinese immigrants, assimilation, so sad. It's about a young man who's half American, half Chinese, and his troubled relationship with his mother who makes him these magical paper animals, and you will cry. It's so good and so sad.
Okay. Well, spilling tears over your summer book is always a good thing, I think. Yeah. And by the way, if you've just joined us, we're talking with Petra Mayer of NPR Books. We will have the list of books she's recommending for summer reading, including Ken Liu's The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories at hereandnow.org. One more book that technically isn't new, but you call it a great summer read, Jane Steele by Lindsay Fay. Now, it has elements of Jane Eyre. Who doesn't have elements of Jane Eyre in their book? But this isn't your mother's Jane Eyre.
No, not at all. So, yeah, I sort of went back and forth about whether this was really a summer book because it came out at the end of March. But what I want in a summer book is I want it to be I want to get sucked right into it. I want it to be fast-paced and immersive, and I want to fall in love with these characters like you fall in love with people at summer camp, sort of brief and intense, and then it's over, you know? So this is a very meta take on Jane Eyre. Interestingly enough, this character, Jane Steele, exists in a world where she knows there's a novel, Jane Eyre, and she wants to read it because it had some weird parallels with her own life. But if you imagine Jane, the original Jane, she kind of gets kicked from pillar to post by unsympathetic grown-ups and jerk men and, you know, mean school headmasters. And this Jane, a lot of the reviews call her a serial killer, but she's not a serial killer, really. She just is prone to very dramatic solutions to her problems.
Oh.
she's not afraid to get someone drunk and push them into a river if they've done her wrong.
I don't think that'd be a good defense.
She's a great character, though, and well worth spending some time with.
It sounds like there's a little bit of satire in there.
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit of satire, but it's also she has agency in a way that the original Jane does not. She lives her own life on her own terms.
For Jane, who couldn't? Okay, we know you have a project you want to talk about. We just want to get a quick mention in here. Read, Watch, Binge.
Yeah, this is the Arts Desk's big summer project. It's based on the idea of recommendation algorithms. So if you you go to Amazon, it says people who bought this book bought that book. So our big innovation is humans. These are a series of three lists that are intensively curated by actual real humans. One is a movie list. One is a book list that's going to come out soon. The movie list is actually already up. And then last one will be for TV. And the idea is, for example, if you like this movie, you should read this book, but also watch this TV show or maybe check out this podcast. We give you a whole bunch of sort of cross-platform content, which sounds very dry, but I promise there's some really great stuff in there.
Now, that is so cool, because sometimes you finish seeing, okay, Call the Midwives has ended for the season, but what might be a book that could continue it for you?
Yeah, actually, Call the Midwife is one of the titles that's on our movie list. We paired it with Brooklyn, which is that movie with Saoirse Ronan, and she's a young Irish immigrant in Brooklyn in the 1950s. And we thought they had a similar feel to them about sort of young women making their way in the world. And if you like one, you might like the other.
Oh, this is great. I'm on the website now, and I'm scrolling down. I'm seeing if you like The Hunger Games, you might also like Battle Royale or The Most Dangerous Game. That's a book. Like Zootopia, you might also like The Sneetches and Other Stories by Dr. Seuss or Watership Down by Richard Adams. This is great. This is
great.
Thank
you. I got a lot of grief for recommending Watership Down, but I think if your kids are grown up enough for Zootopia, they can take Watership Down. It's a great book, and I wish I'd read it sooner than I did.
And here it is. If you like Call a Midwife, you might also like the film Brooklyn and the novel Willa Cather's My Antonia. And that's a recommendation from Lynn Neary. So we
you can
know
trust
it,
her.
Yeah, we know it's good. We'll link you up to the NPR site at hereandnow.org. Petra Mayer of NPR Books, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Happy reading.
We got news today that applications to refinance home loans jumped 21% last week over the week before. That's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. And it makes sense because the interest rates on home loans have fallen to near historic lows following the Brexit vote in the UK. So what does all this mean for you, for the housing market, and for the larger economy? Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So tell us, first of all, how low interest rates actually are right now.
Oh, they are low. Have you seen those happy real estate people staking the open houses in your neighborhood? You know you have.
Yeah.
That gives you a hint. 3.38% is what I saw today on our CNN
wow.
Money website for a fixed 30-year. Lowest in 3 years, but you are right. Those are near historic lows. And the reason that we have interest rates dropping so much right now is that you have a lot of uncertainty in the world. Basically, investors are nervous about what Britain exiting the European Union means, the Brexit we all talk about. They're nervous about the Chinese economy and currency, and they're nervous about what all of this means for U.S. corporate profits. When investors are nervous, especially investors around the world, they flock to the safety of gold and government bonds, particularly U.S. government bonds.
Right.
And when that happens, you see the price go up, the yield go down, and that's what interest rates are benchmarked against. So that is why you are seeing this downward pressure on rates here. That's reflected in mortgage rates.
And when we hear that they're near historic lows, is there a chance that they could go even lower, or is this about as good as you could get?
No, listen, there's a chance that they could go lower. We're in a very unusual situation where you have some countries around the world that have negative interest
right.
rates. That means investors are paying them to hold their to hold on to them. They're not even making any money off them. Now, people don't think that's going to happen here, but certainly you could start to see them inch down even lower.
So what does all this mean for the housing market right now?
It means that, especially if you're looking to buy a home, it's good news. It's going to lend support to this sector, which has been improving. Now, obviously, you see it most markedly in refinancing. Home sales and regular mortgage applications are also seeing a boost. But you have a couple of factors which are kind of keeping a little bit of a lid on action in that department. Even though you have the low rates, that's kind of motivating people to get out there. I mentioned all those happy real estate people you see. But that means inventory's low. Houses are going when they go on the market. Prices are getting pushed up with all of that demand. And remember, you still have tighter lending requirements. That hasn't changed post-financial crisis. So even though housing is strong, you still have to qualify for that mortgage. So it's keeping a little bit of lid on that sector of the market. But refinancing, as you mentioned, is really exploding as a result of this.
That your credit still has to be very good in order for
yes.
you to get access
yes.
to that money, even if you can find it very cheap.
That is exactly right. And that is why those with the best credit, once again, are benefiting from this. Those that are a little bit further down the food chain who probably need the most help from being able to refi, they may not be able to qualify. It doesn't mean they won't, and you should probably try after you talk to your financial advisor to see if you can. It doesn't mean you won't be able to, but obviously those with the best credit in this kind of environment are going to benefit the most from this drop in interest rates.
Now, I know that you don't want to give advice, Maggie. That's not what you do.
That's right.
But I do want to ask you this. If somebody is sitting there saying, well, I wonder if I should refinance at this point, what do the experts say about that?
Well, listen, I mean, I think any expert would tell you that if you think that you can and it's going to help your balance sheet, you should look into it, right? You can always have someone run the numbers for you and see if you qualify. There are always costs associated with it. So you have to take all of that into account, which is why you should talk to, a financial expert or a bank, certainly your local banker, to find out if it's going to happen. And the other thing is, you know, this is an unusual situation where no one expected interest rates to be this low right now. And a lot of this is being influenced by the global economy. You said, can they go lower? Yes. Does it mean they're going to stay here? Not necessarily. So you probably do want, if you're thinking about it, see if you are able to take advantage of this time right now.
And do these low interest rates and these low rates on mortgages also extend to other kinds of loans that people get?
Unfortunately, credit cards don't fluctuate with these daily rates, which I think is what we all wish could happen right now to get a benefit from that. But certainly other type of bank loans do, auto loans, again, other factors that play there. But they are also near historic lows. The issue, again, though, just like with everything else, is the requirements are stricter. Again, it's the people with the best credit who are going to be able to benefit from these other areas as well. But it's something you want to look into.
And when you have this flight to safety that causes this to happen, as you talk about, when things are getting a little hairy out there in the economy, people rush to government bonds, and that's what drives these interest rates down. There's also the risk of recession, and people are worried that there may be quite a high risk of recession in the next year. Just in the next few seconds, Maggie, what are people thinking about the overall economy right now?
I think experts are really divided about this, Jeremy. And you're right. When rates are low, it doesn't benefit anyone if you don't have a job or you're uncertain about the future. And if that is what happens as a result of all this uncertainty, then that is going to be a problem. Right now, a lot of people think that the U.S. economy is sheltered to a certain extent from what's happening globally, from Brexit, for example. But the Federal Reserve is watching this really closely. As we know, we are all interconnected. Right now, it looks like we have a great scenario that Goldilocks, low interest rates, things are looking pretty good. We have an important jobs report Friday that's going to shed a lot of light on that, though.
And we will be watching to see what that says this Friday from the Labor Department. Maggie Lake, host CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks so much, as always.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.